The new Netflix series, Murder Among the Mormons, recounts those first days of confusion and fear when pipe bombs killed two people in Salt Lake City. It's 1985. You see footage from the time, news reports. And then a third bomb goes off the next day. Mark Hoffman is almost killed, and what the film shows is that at this point in the story, before anyone knows Hoffman himself was the bomber and a forger, people thought he was just this mild-mannered document dealer, a local boy, a churchgoer, former missionary. And there's this remarkable moment in the film where this young man shows up on the scene right after the explosion. He sees Hoffman there in the street, recognizes his LDS garments, and gives him a blessing.
A witness said he rushed to his aid and gave Hoffman a blessing.
He was wearing the LDS garment, and I took out my oil, consecrated oil that I usually carry with me, and I commanded him to live and that proper medical help would get to him quickly, which it did.
You commanded him to live?
I commanded him to live.
The television reporter Michael Rawson was also one of the first ones there.
I remember getting a call from the desk very early in the morning, and they told me there had been a bombing at the judge building. And it just, what? A bombing in Salt Lake? I didn't know what to make of it. And then the second bombing. Then we knew, oh boy, this is something. And it was then that the link between historical documents and Mark Hoffman started to surface. And then on the next day, I heard a big bomb. I was close enough to the scene that I actually heard it. And I was one of the first reporters there. They had just removed Mark Hoffman. He was fighting for his life. He'd been seriously injured, and his car, his little sports car, was still smoking, and I got close enough to see all kinds of papers just floating around. So there I am. It's a crime scene. I'm always looking for people that would have a story to tell, and I saw this young man, and I just went up to him, and he said, oh, yeah, I was one of the first here at the scene. I tried to help him. And that's when he told me about how he commanded Mark Hoffman to live.
You commanded him to live?
I commanded him to live.
He didn't just ask the Lord for help in preserving this man's life. He commanded through his priesthood that this man should live. He must have gotten there before the emergency crews did, and then noticed Mark Hoffman's garments, and then that inspired him to give him a blessing. I'm guessing he still believes he did the right thing.
The poor man didn't know. He didn't know he was given a blessing to Satan. But it wasn't his fault. He was doing what? He was doing the right thing. As far as he knew, he had no idea it was Satan lying there.
We see you and this young man early in the film, and I think episode one. And then in episode three, we see that same scene play out again. But now, as we're watching it, we know who Mark Hoffman is and what he's done. And Shannon Flynn, of course, says, and he gets emotional about this in the scene. He says, that poor young man who gave Mark Hoffman a blessing, who commanded him by the power of God to live, he didn't know he was giving a blessing to the devil.
Yeah. We have this man without guile, this young man who was just doing his duty. He saw somebody in need. He didn't know any of the history. He was just trying to help. And if you're LDS, active LDS, you're faithful, you have the priesthood, you see somebody in need, that's what you do, is you give them a blessing. You can ask the Lord to save them. This guy went a step further, and using his priesthood, he commanded him to save the soul and the life of this guy that turned out to be a terrible killer. He was being true to his calling. And it was touching to me at the scene. And I had forgotten about him until I saw that interview. I doubly appreciated him for acting in a very stressful time and staying true to his faith and doing something that he believed the Lord had commanded him or wanted him to do.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So clearly the twist that makes this Hoffman story even stranger, even more interesting, is the Mormon angle. The filmmakers Tyler Meesom and Jared Hess focus on the crime. But the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is everywhere in this story. And only part of the role played by the church is explored in the series. So today in the program, we thought we'd talk more about that with the historian Benjamin Park. He teaches at Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas. He writes about Mormon history, and he pays attention to the LDS community. We wanted to know how that community was reacting to the series, but also the way the Hoffman story has affected the church. Of course, very different audiences are now processing the Netflix series. There's the faithful, there are those who have left, and there are those who know very little or nothing about the Mormon backstory. Park said this was a challenge for the filmmakers.
This project in particular is trying to weave so many different stories to so many different audiences that, of course, they're going to have to choose to prioritize some over others. And it's very clear that they chose to prioritize the true crime elements of this story, which meant that they're going to focus on the psyche of Mark Hoffman, focus on his crimes and the grisly details of the murders, and then, of course, the captivating elements of the investigation. The downside of that approach, or at least the roads left uncovered or untraveled, are the broader cultural relevance, which might be more of interest to maybe overly specialized nerds like myself. So I admit that it might be a small cadre of people, but I think the Hoffman crisis, that saga that took place in the 80s, that's a broader American religious and historical story. It's a story of deception, a story of optimism. I mean, America in the 1980s was nothing if not, you know, the dawn of Reagan's New America, and a story of excess resulting in a period of disillusionment and skepticism and division.
We're going to get there. Before we do, I wanted to ask you what you thought about the choice made by the filmmakers, because it was a choice not to focus as much on the role of the LDS Church in the telling of the story. I mean, of course, we have to say it's very much about the church and the role it played in pretty much everything about the story. Of course, the setting, the history, how it motivated Hoffman. But there have been other journalists and writers who have been more focused on these parts of the story and the parts that are more critical of the role of the church. What do you say, what do you think about that choice made by the filmmakers to focus, as you say, on Hoffman himself, on the crime, more than the church part?
I think it's obvious they make this choice because there is a national appetite for this, you know, the murder story, as the Saturday Night Live spoof made fun of a couple weeks ago. This decision that there is a general audience thirsting after the mind of a criminal. And so they're setting aside, I mean, on the one hand, I bet there's a lot of Latter-day Saints who are breathing a sigh of relief. I know, I imagine the institutional churches as well, because they end up, the LDS faith and the LDS institution in general ends up not being the target of this documentary, or at least the primary focus. And by zeroing in on Hoffman, the documentary is going to take in millions of fascinated, you know, listeners or watchers through Netflix, which is why it became, you know, such a quick hit, even if it meant having to overlook other elements of the story.
So the people who knew very little about Mormonism and didn't know anything about Hoffman, they probably found this pretty satisfying then, on that sense.
Yeah, I think so. In that regard, with the framework with which the directors chose, it's an excellent study. It's a study that keeps your attention. I did not think it would be possible to tell the story of Mark Hoffman as a whodunit, having some suspense of what was going on. But they accomplish it. You finish the first episode not knowing what was behind the bombings. You assume that most of the documents Hoffman was dealing were legitimate. And what happens in episode two, while it's, you know, it might seem like a dud to those who are familiar with the story, it really comes to a surprise as a general audience. And I think that's a fascinating feat of documentary filmmaking.
Okay, you mentioned this a little bit before, but I wanted to dig more into this how this is playing out in the 1980s and what's going on in the 1980s, because you mentioned this is part of a larger transition, both within the Mormon faith and the nation itself. So put this in context, the 1980s. Where was the LDS Church at the time in terms of its reputation, the setting? Tell us what's going on in the 80s.
Yeah, well, 1980 was a sesquicentennial for the church, the 150th celebration. The church was organized in 1830, and so 1980 was, you know, a coming-of-age story. And Mormonism had spent its first century kind of as a cultural pariah, a group of people who were pushed to the margins, which for a long time the Latter-day Saints were fine with. They claimed that we're peculiar people and we're not going to fit into, you know, this ungodly and corrupt society. But as the 20th century moved along, Latter-day Saints bent over backwards to be further admitted into the wider culture, going through this process of assimilation in which they eventually become what they're known today as, you know, one of America's most distinct churches, as the American religion. And 1980 was, in many ways, the climax of that, because they had worked for over 50 years to finally shake hands with the broader culture. You had lots of politicians who are praising the LDS Church and their programs. You have cultural figures like the Osmonds who are captivating the national imagination. And to a great degree, the LDS Church had reached a point of cultural acceptance that was much higher than they ever had before. And so 1980 was, you know, a moment of celebration for the LDS Church, to where it finally seemed like they were reaching that end goal that had long seemed impossible.
I wanted to ask about the intellectual debates that are going on within Mormonism around this time, because you write about the fact that this Hoffman story is playing out in this time when there are all these questions going on within the Mormon intellectual community, which you describe as this kind of newfound openness from church leadership about their history. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the 1970s is fondly remembered by many people in the Mormon history community as Camelot. What happened was, there was a scholar from Utah State University by the name of Leonard Arrington who was appointed the church historian in 1972. He was the first academic to hold that position, which had previously and has since only been held by ecclesiastical leaders who may not have background or any training in the historical profession. And as a church historian, Leonard Arrington had overseen this grand openness to studying the history, getting access to archival sources. And so you see this flourishing new field that comes to be known as New Mormon History, that is both revising the past and explaining it in maybe more humanistic and secular terms that matches the broader academy. Now, not everyone is happy with these developments. Arrington's tenure famously ends in a bit of a clash, and when he is reassigned down to BYU and has to take the History Institute with him, and then they're not going to appoint an academic to that position again. But in general, coming out of the 1970s, it's a new age of Mormon historians where they feel empowered to really study the faith's origins in ways that may not match traditional narratives, but are more attuned to general scholarly questions and standards.
What did Mark Hoffman know about that time period, that there was this sense of new openness? I guess I'm wondering whether or not he took advantage of it in his crimes.
Very much so. He was extraordinarily well read and versed in a lot of this history, which is what made his documents seem so credible. He saw holes in the historical world where something would seem as valid or possible, and he fulfilled it. So, for instance, the famous Salamander letter that he forges, that's based on some interviews from Joseph Smith's contemporaries that connect Joseph Smith to the magic culture. And one rumor that says that Joseph Smith's attempt to get these gold plates was actually led by a toad, and Mark Hoffman just spruces that up and makes it a white salamander, and therefore there you have it. You have this new document, let alone him, you know, mastering the penmanship of these historical characters. He's also able to draw in controversial subjects, the Salamander letter, for obvious reasons, connecting Joseph Smith to the folk magic practice. But he also forges a blessing document for Joseph Smith III, in which in 1844, Joseph Smith allegedly gives a blessing to Joseph Smith III to designate him as the true successor to the church's highest office. This is a claim that at the time, the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had been making for over a century. And they claimed this blessing happens. And here's Mark Hoffman taking advantage of that vacuum of documentary evidence, but a plethora of historical speculation, and creating something that seems valid. So Mark Hoffman was truly able to take advantage of these historical advances. He's not presenting anything that shocked historians. These are documents that reaffirm the general scholarly trends, and he was able to build on that.
Did he have I'm going to have you get into his mind, but that's impossible. But do you think Hoffman had a pattern for doing this? I mean, because you mentioned in your writing that he carefully and gradually evolved in his choices about what documents he would focus on and create and reveal. Did he seem to be going somewhere beyond just sort of messing with the origin story of the church?
Yeah, he seemed to be getting increasingly bold with his documents and challenging traditional narratives of the LDS Church. So it wasn't just, you know, a process of making money. He could have made millions of dollars forging documents that reaffirmed the LDS narrative. But instead, he's choosing documents that that become increasingly controversial. I mean, you look at he produces nearly 50 documents that are eventually acquired by the LDS Church during this period. And if you look over them, you see this general trend of them becoming a bit more challenging with each document. Now, the first one, you know, it reaffirms the Book of Mormon's historicity. Then the next one, it's going to connect, you know, Lucy Mack Smith narrating Joseph Smith's origins in a bit more raw and natural ways. Then we're going to get a document that connects Joseph Smith to the magic culture. And then eventually he's going to try to create, you know, the McClellan collection, which he's never produces, but he leaks out information to others saying, oh, there's some really scandalous information in here. And then eventually his grand design was, you know, to develop the lost 116 pages of the Book of Mormon, which, I mean, we don't have any direct evidence of what's going to be in it, but I wouldn't have been surprised if it was going to present a narrative that was going to directly undercut the traditional narrative of the Book of Mormon.
Well, and that seems obvious, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I want to sort of stop there at this 116 pages. And for those who may not be familiar with it, because you're the man to do this, give us a quick summation about what people are talking about in the 116 pages. It's not fully developed in the docuseries, but it's such a critical, seems anyway, a critical part of the Mormon origin story. And Hoffman certainly figured he was going to make millions and millions off of it if he creates it.
Right. When Joseph Smith produces the Book of Mormon, he goes through several stages of trying to come up with a text that in his narrative, he's creating by translating these records through the seer stone and these gold plates. Well, the first batch of texts they create, and he's using Martin Harris, one of his earliest converts, as his primary scribe. Martin Harris has a wife and a family who are not too enthralled with him spending so much time and their resources in supporting who they saw as a religious fanatic. And so Martin Harris convinces Joseph Smith to allow him to take their batch of writing that they had produced to that point to go show them, look, I'm actually doing something. This isn't hocus pocus. This isn't made up. And then the story goes that Martin Harris takes those documents and loses them. And we have no idea what happened to those documents. To this day, there's speculation, but no hard evidence on what happened on those 116 pages of the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith then claims to receive another revelation.
Let's just say that there among the speculation is the idea that Martin Harris's wife or others who wanted to embarrass Joseph Smith in this budding new faith, they took it as a way of saying, all right, you've got this 116 pages that are now missing. It's easy. Just go back to the golden plates and redo it. That's right. An important part of the story, it seems.
Right. And as soon as they do, they would then compare this new document that Joe Smith creates to the original papers that he wrote and say, look, there are differences. There's differences here. He's obviously making it up. And now it's fascinating how Hoffman is laying the groundwork for this, because the Salamander letter, besides just being a salacious document that connects Joseph Smith to this, you know, seemingly occult folk magic practices, it's also in Martin Harris's hand, which just so happens to be the handwriting that the 116 pages would be in. So you could envision this point in the future where he would imagine providing these 116 pages, and as they go through the verification of it, they're like, well, what document do we have in Martin Harris's hand to compared? Oh, we have the Salamander letter. So you have a Hoffman forgery that's going to verify another Hoffman forgery.
Benjamin Park, he's an assistant professor of history at Sam Houston State University, author of the book Kingdom of Nauvoo. You can find links to his recent articles on Mark Hoffman and the Netflix series Murder Among the Mormons on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
I'm reporter David Fox. KUER has teamed up with the Salt Lake Tribune for an investigative project called Sent Away. We're exploring Utah rehabilitation centers, where teenagers from across the nation are treated for drug abuse and mental health problems. The state kept its records on the conditions at these centers locked away. We're changing that with a public database so parents can see inside the places their kids are going. You can search it and read our recent reporting at KUER.org/sentaway.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the historian Benjamin Park about the new Netflix series Murder Among the Mormons, which relates the story of the forger and bomber Mark Hoffman. The series focuses more on the crime story than the role of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, so we thought we'd look more into that angle and how it affected the church and churchgoers. Let's talk about how the church itself handles all of this and the role of Gordon B. Hinckley. Talk a little bit about Gordon B. Hinckley in the sense that you've in your writing you mentioned that he had this background in media. He was, a lot of people think, a sort of a PR genius in many ways. He crafted the image the LDS Church would present to the world for a number of decades. And you say in this sense, this makes Gordon B. Hinckley uniquely positioned to handle this crisis, because it was a crisis, it seemed.
Yeah, very much so. And he just so happened to be in that position. He had recently been added to the First Presidency, the governing council of the LDS Church, just a few years previous, because the president at the time and the other counselors were all physically incapacitated. They were all going through major health problems related to being quite elderly at the time of their leadership. And so Gordon B. Hinckley is at first added as an extra counselor, and then eventually he becomes a second counselor, and he ends up being the point person. I can't imagine another church leader from the surrounding decades around that moment who would have been more prepared to handle that crisis, because he was someone who knows to build relationships with journalists and, you know, present a very, you know, outward-facing image to the general public, knowing that our outward posture is just as important as our message if we're wanting to maintain this good reputation that we had spent decades in building. Now, these documents are going to cause a problem to that, because just at this moment of cultural assimilation that had been their end goal for a long time, now we're getting some documents that are recasting the origins of the church that presented as seemingly non-Christian, more cult-like, more scandalous. And this just so happens to be taking place at the same time that American evangelicals throughout the 1980s, mostly in response to the newfound political power they are holding due to the rise of the religious right, they're starting to police their boundaries and calling out what they call the rise of new cults. And there's a series of these national bestsellers focused on specifying, highlighting, and denouncing these cult churches that do not meet the proper standards of American Christians. And as part of that movement, you get evangelical groups that create the movie The God Makers, which ends up being a very popular movie among these groups that has showings across America to hundreds of thousands of believers that cast Mormons as non-Christian, non-American, you know, crazy fanatics. And here are these historical documents that seem to reaffirm those unbelievable origins. And so Gord B. Hinckley and the leaders of the church are not quite sure how to handle that. They don't want to just dismiss them because we are well past the point in, you know, the history where they can take such an oppositional approach. So Gord B. Hinckley and other leaders say, well, why don't we need to deal with them. We will access these documents. We will acquire them either through our own purchase or organizing some donor like Steve Christensen to buy them. And then we are going to have our growing number of LDS historians who we have been entrusting our past, like Leonard Arrington and others, to explain to us what these documents mean. Now, one of the first documents that Hoffman sells to the church that is quite salacious was an 1825 letter from Joseph Smith to Josiah Stoll, which connects Joseph Smith to treasure digging. And the LDS Church acquires that document and then basically doesn't do anything with it. They don't alert historians that it's available. They have some of the historians on their payroll do research, but they mostly stay quiet about it. And I think that's why when Mark Hoffman sells them the Salamander letter or sells the letter to Steve Christensen, who donates to the church, he also doesn't make the mistake of not telling anyone else. He tells lots of people, hey, I just provided this Salamander letter. And so there is immense speculation around this letter and what it says, which kind of forces the church's hand to in turn release it to the public. They even publish a transcript of it in the church news, causing all this, you know, discussion, historical debate, and revisiting the past. And then the church, of course, was quite relieved when it turns out all these documents were forgeries. But from that point on, historians and the church itself could no longer ignore the folk magic context of the early church. Because even though these documents were no longer seen as reliable, as I mentioned earlier, they were not made to surprise historians. There's enough evidence outside of the Salamander that connects Joseph Smith to the folk magic culture. So Mark Hoffman, in a way, even though he undercut the historical profession, he ended up buttressing the revisionist take on reviewing the origins of the church, forcing the church leaders to deal with the new narrative.
Don't you think, Benjamin Park, that Gordon B. Hinckley must have hated also being in the center of this, in the sense that he was the highest ranking church official who had dealt personally with Mark Hoffman. It is clear they had some sort of a relationship, and others have raised questions. And this is one of those things that Jared Hess and Tyler Meesom don't really get into terribly deeply, but I wanted to ask you about. Because there are a number of questions about, you sort of alluded to this, whether in fact the church was buying documents to keep them from the public and raise questions about the origins of the faith, whether church leaders had been fully cooperative with authorities trying to investigate the Hoffman case. That comes up in the film, actually. But also this question about whether church officials, for example, intervened in the judicial process to keep leaders in high office from being embarrassed or having to testify on record. There was some question about whether Gordon B. Hinckley, for example, was going to have to testify in that trial. And that could have been remarkably embarrassing for Hinckley himself, but for the church itself as well.
Yeah, I think there's this very interesting shift that the documentary hints at, though it doesn't go into great detail. There's this shift that the church takes toward the Hoffman investigation that at first, when the explosions occur, and after Hoffman himself has critical injuries from the bomb exploding in his car, the detectives are quite clear that the church stays out of it. They say, we don't want to be involved. This is something that is a legal matter. And like you said, they want to, you know, shield the church from any problems, especially if it's going to bring up issues of, is the church suppressing history? Is there a renegade church apologist who's blowing up those who are involved with revising their faith and undercutting traditional beliefs. And then when word starts creeping out that Mark Hoffman might be the perpetrator, and he's a perpetrator because he's been forging documents to fool the LDS institution, then the church jumps in. Then in the summer of 1986, the church provides all these documents to the investigators, gets involved to show these are the 49 documents we have from Mark Hoffman. We are happy to participate this way, because then suddenly the investigation is on someone who is a critic of the church, and that the deeper reading is not going to be something that's going to fool, that is not something that, you know, shows the church is bad, but it shows the church as the victim. And so I think once the church was able to define the terms through which they are going to participate in the investigation, it really opened up another avenue. But as you mentioned, it did raise a lot of questions. I think when you mentioned that Gordon B. Hinckley might have been somewhat embarrassed of his involvement, I imagine he cringed whenever he saw that famous photo of Mark Hoffman showing him and other church leaders those documents, right? Just the mere proximity of church leaders next to a con man and his forgeries who had somehow pulled the wool over, you know, the Lord's anointed, which then becomes all the more, you know, cringeworthy when the one of the first people to question the authenticity of these documents were not LDS leaders, not even faithful historians, but Gerald and Sandra Tanner, some of the foremost critics of the faith who raised questions of the Salamander's authenticity. How could it be that Mormonism's biggest critics end up being more prophetic than the church's leaders, is how many people saw it. And that just raised questions of, you know, how prophetic are our church leaders when it comes to these matters? Are they not supposed to be duped in those endeavors, or do they only speak as prophets when in official role? And how do you define what that official capacity is, and so forth? And it raises questions that I know many critics still cite to this day as evidence that the church can't be what it claims to be.
So what about for those people who have left Mormonism, people who either resigned, they were excommunicated, or they just stopped going altogether? Their expectations, I'm wondering about, as they were anticipating the release of this docuseries about Mark Hoffman. Do you think they were disappointed overall? What are you sensing? What are you hearing, if you are, anything?
I've gotten a sense that they saw it as a missed opportunity, because they were hoping that this was going to be, you know, the sword in the side of the church to reveal it to be the fraud that it really is. And in fact, a general tenor I've been seeing from a lot of critics of the church, or those who are just disillusioned with the faith, is, wow, the documentary should have focused more on how Mark Hoffman was just Joseph Smith reincarnated, another con man who's using fraudulent documents for his own gain, that Mormonism seems to be particularly enriched in raising fraudulent men who know how to take advantage of the gullibility of others. So that seems to be the general feeling I've got from a lot of critics. At least they would say that even if the documentary does not connect these dots, that it at least provides these materials. On the other hand, I've seen lots of faithful Latter-day Saints who are like, whew, dodged a bullet there. You know, focusing on, especially a lot were concerned with the first trailer, which, as any good documentary or movie, is going to try to build suspense, and it doesn't, you know, specify from the start that Mark Hoffman is the bad guy here, and it kind of plays, you know, religion breeds extremity or extreme ideas in people, and they're like, oh no, is this going to be another anti-Mormon hatchet job? When in reality, the documentary presents the church in very positive light. I've seen some people who still harp on, well, the documentary plays on the stereotype of the church suppressing history. But there are, you know, difficult concepts where the church did suppress some parts of the story until later. So I think the narrative is just not as clear as either the critics or the apologists wish it would be.
What do you think about the way they handled Mark Hoffman himself as a personality type, as a character? Because this is a difficult balance to find. You've mentioned it in your own writing about the series, that how do you handle him? Do you treat him as a genius? Do you treat him as a monster? Do you find something in between there? Talk a little bit about that, and also say something about – and I found this really interesting and quite ironic. You mentioned how in many ways – Mark Hoffman fulfills these stereotypes that you often see in anti-Mormon literature.
Right. The man who can pass in any setting, the chameleon who can seem, you know, all business in the front, but is quite deceptive in the back. The person who can come in holding a briefcase and, you know, shake your hand, but as soon as you're out of the room, can, you know, do dealings behind your back that show the true nefarious nature of him. I mean, that's the stereotype that fills anti-Mormon dime novels in the 19th century. And here's Mark Hoffman fulfilling it to a T, ironically, in a way to try to scandalize the church. As you mentioned, it is very difficult to handle someone like Hoffman. It's a difficult balance to maintain, because on the one hand, he was obviously very skilled at what he did. Maybe America's most talented and most successful forger. But as soon as you start presenting him as kind of this, you know, tragic hero or this brilliant mastermind, you're overlooking the fact that his actions led to the deaths of two innocent people and, you know, tragic results and trauma for several families and a broader community. And you don't want to lose sight of that. I think the documentary does a really good job keeping that balance through most of the three episodes. Although I always thought the kind of comedic asides, the very Hessian points where they're recreating, you know, shooting the Uzi and driving the fast car. I had a hard time balancing that lightheartedness with the serious nature of the story. But I know people's tastes can vary on that. I thought in general they did a really good job keeping the victims at the forefront until the last few minutes of the third episode, where they kind of finish with Shannon Flynn, who might be one of the most memorable interviews, and he goes, don't ask me to say that, don't ask me to praise him, because he is worthy of praise, type of thing. But basically he's showing the reluctance to treat Mark Hoffman as a mastermind. And then talks about Mark Hoffman as a mastermind as well. And I thought that moment, that interview, kind of captured the documentary's overall feeling of, we don't want to, you know, highlight his brilliance, but we're going to anyway, because, you know, there's a genre expectation and that's what the audience wants to hear. And, you know, it kind of fits this general narrative. So I think they did a great job on the flight, even if they could have stuck the landing a bit better.
There is this important question in the film expressed by Sandra Tanner, who says that there was a fallout after the Hoffman story broke. She describes it as a great questioning in the community of the basis of their faith. So let's talk a little bit about how Mark Hoffman and this story itself may have transformed the way Latter-day Saints themselves think about the church, things like that. I'm wondering about, like, let's take the Salamander letter first. When it's revealed it was a forgery, you'd think that would be such a relief. But as you've said, it was built on enough actual evidence that it just raised the question. So the question is, did the Salamander letter make it easier for the church to set aside its folk magic origins, or did it just sort of highlight them in some way?
I think it ended up setting up a two-edged sword the way they went about it, because their choice to, instead of ignoring the document or claiming it's fake or saying that, coming up with a host of reasons for why we're just not going to actually engage the document, their response was, well, we're going to have historians investigated. And you have a lot of faithful historians, especially those who are based at BYU, produce a series of scholarship that try to contextualize Joseph Smith as treasure seeker. I'm thinking of one special issue of the Brigham Young's University Studies, which is the flagship scholarly journal based out of BYU, where a number of the faith's most prominent historians write these articles that place the Salamander letter in its broader context. So on the one hand, so I said this is a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, that kind of defanged the Salamander letter by saying, look, it fits in the broader context. It might be awkward for us now. It might not fit our traditional narrative. But look, if you see it in this light, it doesn't seem as scandalous as we initially thought. But then you pull the rug out and say that the Salamander letter is false. But the problem is they've done all this work to recreate this magic culture to understand the salamander letter that still exists after you remove the salamander letter. You can still go to the BYU Studies website and find this issue that once you ignore the salamander letter, it's still a deep investigative look at the cultural origins of Mormonism that cannot be merely dismissed. So the downside, one might say from a perspective, would be like the salamander letter further welded us to understanding the magic culture, which some people are never going to fully get over because it's just so crazy. One might hope that the church would have built on that moment and then integrated the magic culture into traditional narratives, but you don't really see that happening until just the most recent years with like the Gospel Topics essays or the New Saints volumes, which does a much better job. So it took a few decades for the church to actually reckon with these scholarly legacies that they themselves initiated due to the Hoffman forgeries.
So what happens in the years after all of this? It seems you're saying that the Hoffman story kind of fueled this debate, at least in part. And then the debate sort of comes to a peak in 1993. You have six LDS intellectuals who are excommunicated for being outspoken and digging into the church's origins. So what was the Hoffman sort of story that impact? How did the Hoffman story impact the church in that way?
Yeah, I think the phrase I used in my writing that I'm going to plagiarize myself with is that the Hoffman crisis did not create the wars over Mormon history, but it certainly escalated them because it raised the stakes. There had already been historians who had been studying all of these matters, including magic, but now you have these documents that made it much more explicit. And you always had this, you know, apologist segment of the church who is not really comfortable with how far these historians are taking it, are not happy with the approach that we're now going to have a much more integrative view of the history that takes into account these quote unquote dangerous documents. And then after the documents were proven to be forgeries, these apologists, with right reason, could be like, look, your arguments were both the cause and built on a killer, a murderer. You don't want to be aligned with someone like Hoffman by studying this work, do you? And so you end up having this greater clash between those who want to defend traditional narratives, who feel vindicated when they see the Hoffman crisis, versus those revisionists who are saying, look, there's still more to the story. Even when you cut out the salamander letter, there's still, you know, antebellum upstate New York context. And so the stakes rise up, and not all the leaders of the church agreed with Gordon B. Hinckley with how we're going to, you know, deal with it. You have other church leaders like Boyd K. Packer and to a degree Dallin H. Oaks, who said that these historical cultural discussions that were raised due to these documents are dangerous to the faith and we need to move beyond them. These are alternate voices, to use Dallin H. Oaks' famous phrase, to dismiss some of these symposia and curriculum that do not fulfill the faith dialogue. And so I think there, and of course resulting in the September 6 excommunications, and that kind of causes a general chill in the scholarly world. There's been some historians who remark that if you look at the field of Mormon studies, you know, the academics who study Mormonism, there's a vacuum in the 1990s where there weren't, you know, young intelligent, faithful Latter-day Saints going to graduate schools to study Mormonism. And if they do go to graduate school, they leave Mormonism behind because the field had become too hot, too divisive, with these stakes far too high. And it's just, you know, easier to focus on something else. And it's not until the 2000s, not until Gordon B. Hinckley's way of thinking becomes more of the dominant perspective, that things cool off a bit.
You know, it's interesting. Mark Hoffman wanted to cover most of the events in Mormon history if he could. This isn't—he's like a Zelig figure, or, you know, a Forrest Gump kind of figure in some ways. You mentioned he even forged something related to the Mountain Meadows massacre. So he wanted to run the gamut, I guess, which is, I think, interesting.
Yeah, he wasn't putting all his eggs in one basket. I think he was a polymath where it comes to not just his ability to forge different types of documents and different signatures, but he wanted to have his fingers in all different topics. I mean, and outside of Mormonism too, his Oath of the Freeman document would have been, if it went through, would have been arguably the greatest forgery in American history by degree of, you know, significance and money spent on it. He had the Emily Dickinson poem. He had some Jim Bridger documents. If he wanted to, he could have made a much more lucrative career selling these fake documents of Americana. But instead, it was something about Mormonism that kept drawing him back. And as you mentioned, there were lots of facets of Mormonism that he felt he could take advantage of.
There was a time when LDS Church members felt incredibly anxious when national attention became focused on the faith. I think about the anxiety that then-President Gordon B. Hinckley expressed about this interview he had with Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes. And everyone was freaking out about it. Was it going to be favorable to the church? Was it going to be critical? All of those kinds of things. And so with that context, it made me wonder, what effect will this Netflix docuseries have on the reputation of the LDS Church? Because there's a lot of places you can go for critiques about Mormonism, about the origin story, about the role they played in the Hoffman Affair and all these other kinds of things. What effect will this docuseries have, do you think, in the scheme of things?
Honestly, I don't think much, because of the way that the document was framed as a true crime story focused on Mark Hoffman's psyche and the investigation to unravel his claims. I don't think it spends enough time on Mormonism itself to really leave a lasting legacy. From what I can tell, the general public has become fascinated with Hoffman and not Mormonism as a result of this documentary. So maybe there's a broader discussion of how Mormonism fits into, you know, this broader questions of skepticism and authenticity and faith. But because of how the documentary pattern or framed this story, they didn't frame it in a way that would have made Mormonism more relevant to American history. They didn't frame the Hoffman crisis to be relevant to 1980s America. They framed it as making Hoffman relevant to the murder show fascination. So I don't think that this documentary is going to have a lasting impact on the national imagination on Mormonism.
Do you think that I wonder if you think that the Hoffman Affair was a net positive or a net negative for the church, if you think about it. Because you've said in your writing about the series that Mormon historians learned to be more careful, that church leaders learned to take a position toward history that was, you know, less defensive, more accommodating. You could make an argument that Mark Hoffman helped the church in some ironic way.
Yeah, I should say, so at the forefront, in case we lose sight of it, I think we should rightfully see it as a net negative, because it resulted in the deaths of two innocent people and immense tragedy. And I'm sure that goes unsaid, but I want to make sure it's said as well. But I think in the long term, you're right that there's a lot of positives that come out of it.
Let me put it this way, just because I want to be sensitive to what you're saying there.
Yeah.
Not Mark Hoffman himself, but in some ironic way, do you think the Hoffman story, the way it played out, could have been helpful in some ironic way to the church?
I think the Hoffman story had lots of possibilities to be a net negative and a net positive in Mormonism's history since then. And for a while, it looked like it could have been a net negative, because there was a general retrenchment and backtrack against these developments of openness and historical inquiry, and things could have gone really bad. But so in the short term, I think it was very much a net negative in the church's reputation. In the long term, however, I think looking in the much broader trajectory, there's a lot of positives that come out of it. I'm not sure that the church would have come to grips with its controversial origins, understanding magic culture and so forth, as quickly if it were not for the lasting controversies. Because once Arrington was kicked out of the church history department and moved down to BYU, that could have led to a long-term retrenchment of never returning to scholarly investigation. But because Gordon B. Hinckley learned important lessons from the Hoffman episode, because the Hoffman episode forced many historians to do a more open-minded inquiry into the church's origins, I think there are some long-term fruits, even if the seeds seem pretty deeply buried in the 1980s.
Benjamin Park, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Benjamin Park, he's an assistant professor of history at Sam Houston University. He's written a recap to the Netflix series Murder Among the Mormons on the site Religion Dispatches. We have a link to it on our website. His latest book is Kingdom of Nauvoo, The Rise and Fall of a Religious Empire on the American Frontier. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.